Blind Dave, you'll very seldom ever hear Blind Dave that you don't hear Blind Dave and Norma. We're joined at the hip. Norma, would you stand up or something? Where are you? Yeah. So if you ever get a chance to hear her, you don't want to miss that either. And so today I'm packing up, you know, putting stuff in the saddlebags. It's the weather's beautiful. Going to ride the bike, you know, and I got all my bike stuff in the saddlebags and traveling light, you know, and nothing else is going to fit. And I get a call from Charlie who says, Dave, Al says a little jacket would probably be a good idea. And I said, well, I got on my Harley jacket. Is that a good idea? And he said, I don't know, Dave. And anyway, he comes up with this jacket. And so he calls me back and tells me he's got a jacket I can wear. And I said, okay. So he said, it'll probably look real good with blue jeans. And I said, I hope so. This is a little bit out of my league, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, so I get here and Charlie takes me in the other room and he's putting the jacket on me. And my, you know, I've got this thing. And my wife says, good, that'll hide your wife beater shirt. And so then I go in the restroom, and then Charlie says, oh, I said, man, Charlie says, you look really good, Dave, in that jacket. And I said, you know, I don't feel too bad, Charlie. I might have to get one of these, you know, go over to Goodwill and get one or something. And he says, oh, just a minute here. You've got something in And then he turns me around. He says, he gets a wet paper towel, and he says, you got a little spot right here. And here, let me get this. And I said, good grief, now I know why I don't have one. So I hope we can get through this. You know, Charlie was talking about him and Katie and being engaged, and they've been together about 5 years. And I went to hear Katie speak, first time I ever heard Katie, and she was up and she was talking about Lala and telling her story, and she came to meet Charlie in this story. And she said they got to, you know, they reached the point in their relationship where they finally fell in the hay. And she said, and then one thing led to another. And I didn't hear any more of her story. The rest of the night, my head was running all the scenarios of one thing leading to another. So anyway, I'd like to hear your story sometime, Katie. Very good. We're going to do steps 1, 2, and 3 tonight. So let's take just a little moment of silence because I need it if y'all don't. I hope I don't bite that or something. Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Very good. So we're just going to zip through this real quick because you don't do steps 1, 2, and 3 very thorough, and they're steps that need to be done thorough. So tonight we're going to be zipping through them pretty good to try to get it in this little short spot. You know, when they told me I was going to be doing a workshop, I thought this was going to be like at the man-to-man, you know, where I'm sitting in a room in a chair with a few people sitting around me. So I wasn't quite expecting this. But here we go. Step 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And when I start out with guys doing step 1, I tell them this. It tells me not to declare anyone an alcoholic. I've got to let them draw their own conclusion. That's in the chapter Working with Others. What it tells me to do on page 92 is to speak of alcoholism as an illness, of body and mind which accompany it. So my job then is to present a model of alcoholism and let them see if they fit it. So I went through the book and came up with the conditions of body and mind which accompany alcoholism, kind of looking at the characteristics of the illness. And I've came up with 4 common characteristics that I like to spotlight, and we're going to call them A, B, C, and D. So A, we're going to look at the physical addiction. There is a physical component to addiction, to alcohol, and we're going to start with the doctor's opinion. In the 4th edition, that would be XXVIII. I don't guess y'all are flipping to that, are you? Okay, it says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago, this is Dr. Silkworth, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. So we're talking about the allergy concept when we're looking at the physical aspect of alcoholism. And that was a strange idea when I first come into AA. You know, I'm what they call a hypoallergenic person. I don't recall I've ever had a rash to anything. I grew up playing in the woods. I've never had poison ivy. I just don't get things like that. I've never broke out because of some kind of soap or... And every time I ever go to the doctor's office and they give you these papers to fill out and they ask you, do you have high blood pressure? Do you have diabetes? You know, they ask you all them questions. And then they always say, are you allergic to any medications? And I've always said, no. I've never had an allergic reaction to anything. Boy, my wife had an allergic reaction to some perfume I gave her for Christmas year before last. She put that stuff on, and by the time we got her to the hospital, her feet were swollen. She couldn't get her shoes on, and you know, when we took her in the emergency room, they put it on New Year's Eve night, right after midnight, and the emergency room was full. And they pushed everybody out of the way and took her straight in. They take that anaphylactic reaction serious. And I am not one of them kind of people. And so when I came into AA, and they said, well, you see, Dave, you have an allergy to alcohol. And I thought, no, I don't. I'm not allergic to any medications. I couldn't wrap my mind around that. But if you've had a problem with that, all we're talking about here is the phenomenon of craving. That's all. Dr. Silkworth wasn't sure what category to put that in, but he decided to put it in the category of being an allergy. The phenomenon of craving is limited to these allergic types. And that's all we mean by the allergy. Is that for some reason, when I take... the drink of alcohol, there's a few drugs that do the same thing to me. I kind of get an itch for some more. So that's all we mean by that. So moving on from that, it says on page 22, paragraph 4, it says, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other people. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So I don't spend a whole lot of time talking to people about the allergy because it's the lesser of the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. If the allergy was all there was to alcoholism, all you got to do is get it out of my system. See, you know, people come into the treatment centers, they say, with their ass on fire. Actually, their whole world is on fire. And some of them need some medical assistance to get through that detox process. I mean, you know, they could have a seizure or some serious reactions to detoxing, so some of them need medical assistance. Takes about a week to get them through the detox process. And if that's all there was to alcoholism was the physical allergy, then it would be over. You know, you pull them out of the fire, you put the fire out, and, you know, give them a few meals and a few good night's sleep, and you say, now, don't do that again. And just like they do, they say, don't worry, I won't. But you open the door and let them go, and they walk right out and jump back in the fire. And we have astonished society for centuries. Why? When they put the fire out and get us recuperated a little bit and back on our feet, we walk out, and if we have to, and go jump back in the fire. Why? The main problem of the alcoholic is in his mind. So we're going to look at the mental obsession. This is B, the mental obsession, and it's on page 30, starting at the beginning there. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. So we're talking about a mental obsession that hangs on to us long after the physical allergy. But now, apart from the physical allergy, the mental obsession is not near so strong. In fact, it's just that little thing that taps me on the shoulder frequently and says, you know, your old lady's going to be out of town all weekend. You know, it's just always there to tap me on the shoulder. It's kind of funny. I was in a restaurant yesterday with a couple of buddies that I hadn't seen in a while, and we're sitting at this table talking all kind of AA this and talking about recovery, and there's a couple of ladies a couple of tables over from me, chatter, 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 and I'm trying to block them out, you know, because I'm trying to stay focused on this conversation. And all of a sudden, out of all that chatter, I thought I heard the word opium. And all of a sudden... And now I'm trying to get these guys, you know. it just taps you on the shoulder right in the middle of a crowd, you know. And that persists for a long time. But, you know, all by itself, that's all it is a tap on the shoulder, a tap on the shoulder. I will say this about the mental obsession is that it is persistent. But now, once I finally yield to that and pick up the drink and put it in my system. Once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense. You see, when I get the allergy in there with the obsession, I create a cycle or a loop. It's just like a feedback loop. If I got this microphone right here and went over and got too close to the PA speaker, what would happen? Yeah, feedback. You know, we'd get a squeal, and it's a feedback loop, and the sound going in this microphone would come out that speaker and go back in the microphone and create a loop, and that loop is self-sustaining. It's not going to stop. Sometimes it even grows louder. And somebody's got to break the loop. You've either got to get me away from the microphone or shut off the PA to stop this cycle once it's in motion. And once I take any alcohol, whatever, into my system, and now it's like that little whispering voice that keeps tapping me on the shoulder. Now it's got a microphone and a PA. And, you know, and it's not just whispering about a drink. It's demanding another drink, loud and clear. And I've created a loop. And I've got the cycle turning. And through the years, it gets harder and harder for me to break out of that cycle. In the beginning, it just took a hard weekend, you know, and a bad hangover, and but before long, it started spilling into the week, and then into the next weekend. And many of us, people like Charlie over there, loved your story, Charlie. before long, I've got to run out of money, and then you've got to run out of money, and then you've got to run out of things that was left laying around. And then the police have to start stepping in. And then the hospitals have to start stepping in before the loop is broken. Both of these, the allergy and the obsession, are progressive features of the illness. It gets easier to fall into the cycle and harder to break out of it over the years. We're going to talk about the progressive feature of the illness just a little bit. Because, when I talk to high-bottom drunks and I mention the allergy, sometimes that's a foreign concept to people and they don't really identify with that. And when I talk about you've got this mental obsession, it's going to drive you right through the gates of insanity or death. Well, some of these high-bottom drunks, they go, I don't feel so close to insanity or death. They don't really connect with that either sometimes. So here's where I'm hopefully going to get the high-bottom drunks to connect and to identify with it, you see. Because in describing progression, I say all of us, we probably had our first drink back in high school, somewhere, like Charlie says, heck, these days it's elementary school. But for most of us, it was probably back in high school that we had our first, you know, really good weekend of pulling a drunk. Back then, it was whenever we'd get a chance, and it was just sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And we were having a good time. If my drinking increased, it was probably circumstantial. Let's talk here about the normal social drinker. Because at this point, he's just like us. In high school, we were mingling with that crowd and just like them. But we graduated from high school. We went off to college, maybe. And we got into the college scene. We got away from mom and dad, and we were drinking more. And the parties got bigger and better. And so even the normal social drinker went through a spell there where he was drinking, just, you know, his drinking increased also. But now here's where we part, see. At some point in the normal drinker's life, usually about his mid-20s, he's going to wake up one morning because he's graduated from college, he's got his career going, he's got married, maybe got his first kid. And he wakes up some morning and he thinks, man, this foolishness is going to cost me my career. It's going to cost me my wife. I better cut back a little bit. So he figures out what he can drink, and everybody be okay with that. And he promises his wife, and he draws a line in the sand, and he says, I will drink up to this line and stop. And that's what he does. He drinks up to that line and stops. He may come vacation or Super Bowl Sunday or some special occasion, he'll have an extra drink or two. The big book says he wakes up Monday morning, shakes it off, and goes back to work. I wake up Monday morning thinking of next Friday or looking for another drink. See, I don't shake it off as easy as him. But now, I'm just like him in the sense that got out of college, started my career, got married for the first time. And, and you know, somewhere about the mid-20s, for me it was 24 years old, when I thought, man, I gotta do something about this. It's going to cost me my career. It's going to cost me my marriage. And so I did the same thing. I figured out what would be a safe amount to drink and party, and I drew that line in the sand just like him. I said, I'll drink up to this line and stop. And from that day, the battle has been on. I didn't know I had a problem until then. Then I tried to not want to admit to myself that I had a problem. For him, he drew a line in the sand. That was the end of the matter. For me, I drew a line in the sand, and that was the beginning of the matter. The big book says that our life becomes characterized from that point on. Our life becomes characterized by countless vain attempts to try to be like him. I was working with a guy one time. I talked about the allergy. He didn't quite relate. I talked about the obsession, insanity, and death, and he wasn't quite identifying with that. And he said, Dave, this is why I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic. I said, why? He said, well, because all my life, every time I've needed to cut back, I've been able to do so. I said, really? Every time? He said, every time. I said, well, the question is this. How many times have you had to make that decision? He said, oh, over 100, I'm sure. And then he almost fell on the floor laughing. He said, I see what you mean. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control. But these intervals were usually brief and then inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness over any considerable period. It gets worse, it never better. It don't stop. Just brief pauses sometimes is the best we can do. You know, I like to, when I talk about the progressive feature of this illness, I say progression is a constant force pushing me toward a drink. This constant force is like gravity. Gravity is a constant force. See, if I park my car on a hill and pull, you know, and I get out and I'm walking away and it slips out of gear and it's starting to roll down the mountain and someone says, Dave, your car's rolling, you know. This is just an analogy, y'all. So I run, you know, I run down and I catch up to that car and I grab it by the bumper and I strain myself with everything I've got and I manage to stop the car from rolling. Is the crisis over? No, I've just changed the nature of the crisis. The crisis was my car's loose and rolling down the mountain. Now the crisis is I'm trying to hold the car from rolling. All I've done is switched the problem from an external crisis to an internal crisis. The first time, and this is when I really connected in rooms of recovery, the first time I heard somebody say, if you're thinking about drinking, or if you're thinking about not drinking, either way, you're thinking about drinking. Oh, I got it. Oh, I got it. Whether the car is rolling or whether I'm holding the car from rolling, there's still a crisis here. There's a constant force. And I can tell you that if I'm holding that car from rolling, somebody better come along pretty soon and say, Dave, let me hop in here and pull the brake for you. Thank you. If someone don't get in that car and pull the brake, I can tell you that gravity is going to win this one. I don't know when, but I can promise you it's going to win. And you may be a little bit bigger guy than me, and you may say, oh, I can hold my car. I mean, I can grab it here, I can hold it. And I say, well, if you don't let me get in there and pull the brake for you, you may hold the car a little longer than me, but I can still promise you that gravity is going to win. And I can become just as miserable not drinking as drinking. I tell them at the treatment center, I say, people used to say, don't go over to Dave's house, he's drinking. Then they'd say, don't go over to Dave's house, he's not drinking. I went through my two divorces in sobriety when I was trying to not drink. So we got this analogy about gravity and the car parked on a hill, and that's just the way it is. Now, you're holding the car. You say, well, I'm just going to let it go. Well, now here's alcoholism. You're chained to the bumper of the car. And if your foot slips or you let go of it, it's going to take you down the mountain with it. It's going to cost you your job. It's going to cost you your marriage. It's going to cost you a lot of things. It's going to peel the hide off of you as it drags you with it. The big book says alcoholism annihilates everything worthwhile in life and engulfs all whose lives touch yours. Before long, you'll be dragging all them with you. Really glad you Al-Anons are here. It takes something like Al-Anon to teach y'all how to let go. What a painful thing to have to do without support. So that's progression. And hopefully you can see it at the early stages. Is there seeming to be a force trying to, whether you're drinking or whether you're not drinking? Either way, you're thinking about drinking. Why should my life be so consumed? Why should so much of my energy go to this problem of whether I'm drinking or whether I'm not drinking? I've never been able to direct my energy and experience my full potential, as Charlie said, because this took up all my time, all my energy, whether I'm drinking or whether I'm not drinking. And it annihilates everything worthwhile in life. And over any considerable period, it gets worse and never better. So with all that, a person say, my God, well, thanks for the warning. I'm just going to double up my effort and make sure I don't ever pick up the first drink and set the terrible cycle in motion. Well, it doesn't matter how much I warn you about the woes of alcoholism. I can also prophesy to you, just like they did to Fred in chapter 3, that you will not be able to know. So we're going to look at feature D. This is the mental blank spot. And looking on page 24, paragraph 2, it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. Notice it did not say at all times. It said at certain times. Most times, when I'm really determined, I can refuse a drink. What I'm powerless over is when the time is and when the time isn't that I get to choose that. So we're going to look at Page 36, paragraph 1. This is Jim. Jim was a car salesman, had a couple of months sobriety, but failed to enlarge upon his program. And he decided to drive out to the edge of town one day where he thought he'd find someone interested in buying a car, and he stopped at a restaurant to have a sandwich and a glass of milk. Y'all know the story. And he says, I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in this milk, it wouldn't bother me since I had a full stomach. He said, I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. Now the allergy. He said, and the experiment went so well that I ordered some more milk and another whiskey and poured it into more milk, and that didn't seem to bother me. So I tried another. Thus started one more journey back to the asylum for Jim. And, then on page 37, paragraph 2, going on there, it says, we have sometimes reflected on the consequences more than Jim did, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that paralleled our sound reasoning. There inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. So, you see, when I was going through this thing looking for the features, the conditions of body and mind, you know, that accompany alcoholism, I said, okay, there's an obsession and there's an allergy. So when I read stuff about the physical part, I put it over here in the category with the allergy. When I read stuff about the mental part, I put it over here under the category of the mental obsession. And then one day I'm reading along here about this mental blank spot, and I start to put this in the category with the mental obsession, and I said, wait a minute. He's not talking about the mental obsession. He's talking about something else. There are two aspects to the mental component of this illness. The mental obsession and the mental blank spot. And the blank spot, the sound reasoning, there's the mental obsession and my sound reasoning or my willpower. And the blank spot doesn't occur in my obsessive thinking. It occurs in my sound reasoning thinking. And so the obsession, you know, it's thought, counter thought, going on all the time. Have a drink. No, have a drink. No, I promised. Have a drink. No, the judge said, have a drink. You know, and so, you know, this is going on. And if I'm an alcoholic, I do not know that there is a hole in my sound reasoning paddle. And you know what? I may play ping pong just fine for quite a while with that rim of a paddle. In fact, you know, I may just feel like the ping pong champ. I say, man, I got this in the bag. And all of a sudden, whoosh, it goes right through the hole. And I could swear I was on that ball. The big book says we find ourselves pounding the bar saying, how did I get started again? And if I don't go out deliberately to get drunk because the old lady made me mad or something, then the blank spot will get me. Someday. Guaranteed. So, now we're going to look at Fred. Page 39, paragraph 2, and the last part of that paragraph. Fred, he says, Fred was an accountant, y'all know, and says, we first saw Fred in a hospital about a year ago where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he'd come to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated he might be worse than he thought. For a while, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind not to drink anymore. It never occurred to him he may not be able to do so in spite of his character and standing. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. See, they told him the A, B, C, and D of alcoholism. He says he was interested and agreed he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long ways from admitting it. When they got to this part about the mental blank spot that guaranteed his failure, he didn't believe that. Picking up by page 40, paragraph 2, now Fred speaking. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I simply did not think it'd be possible for me to drink again, especially after what y'all told me. See, they scared him with A, B, and C. He said, I reasoned I was not as bad as you guys, and I'd been successful in licking all my other problems, and I'd be successful where you guys failed. I figured I had every reason to be confident. It was only be a matter of exercising my willpower, keeping on guard. In that frame of mind, I left the hospital, and for a time, all went well. So, in that what frame of mind? I'm going to exercise my willpower and keep on guard. I'm not going to go to sleep at the wheel. And he said, for a time, all went well. That means that he was having no trouble refusing the thoughts of a drink. It also means that they were tapping him on the shoulder. But he was not having any trouble refusing it. He was slapping them thoughts away and doing so fine with that rim of a paddle that he said, I began to think I was making a big deal out of nothing. One day I went to Washington on some government business, and he said it was a successful day. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. The end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. I went back to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, now, that has been happening to him ever since he left the hospital. Tap on the shoulder, tap on the shoulder. He's had no trouble slapping it away. On this day, he crossed the threshold of the dining room, tapped him on the shoulder, and said, a cocktail would be nice before dinner. So I sat down and ordered one. Oh, by the way, Jim said when he poured that whiskey in the milk, he said, I had a vague sense I was not being any too smart. You see, we are unable to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force. Jim had a vague something. He just couldn't quite recall what it was. Fred didn't even have that. He was totally blank. It tapped him on the shoulder and said, order a cocktail with dinner. So he sat down and ordered one, just like that. Then he said, then I ordered another one. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me that a highball would be nice before dinner. Notice it tapped him on the shoulder when he crossed the threshold of the dining room. But once he's had a couple of drinks, now it goes, get me another one. It struck him then, see. Once you set the terrible cycle in motion, it don't talk nice anymore. Get me another drink. Knock him out of the way. It struck me a highball would be nice before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having a few more that night and plenty next morning, and a hazy recollection of getting on an airplane back to New York and meeting a friendly taxi cab driver that I thought was my wife who escorted me around for a few days. I'd like to hear that fifth step. He said, as soon as I gave my, he ended up back in the hospital. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went over that day in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatever against the first drink. I remembered what them alcoholic people told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come. See, it's at certain times that my best effort would just misfire. And he said, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned about alcoholism in the ABC did not occur to me at all. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I'd never understood men who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I understood then. It was a crushing blow. The idea that we will ever be normal has to be smashed. In D here, the mental blank spot is the crushing blow. Your best effort, and even when you're doing great for weeks or months, sometimes even years, I can promise you, I can prophesy to you that you've got an appointment with a mental blank spot. And once you pick up that drink, the nightmare starts over. And what I learned today is that I'm not powerless over every drink. What I'm really powerless over is my alcoholic mind. And I don't know when that day is going to be. Once more, the last of that chapter says, once more, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human power can provide such a defense, except in a few rare cases, at certain times. See, I don't know when that's going to show up. So even if willpower, I can do pretty good 364 days out of the year, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And his defense must come from a higher power. brings us to step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We're going to be looking here at the chapter, We Agnostics. Now, even when I have people that say, well, I believe in God. You know, I'm not having a problem with that. I said, you're going to go through this with me anyway. Because I find out that people who have prior religious convictions have God in a box and are just as rigid and fixed about what they believe is about God as the atheist and the agnostic. They're just as fixed on what they believe about God. And for an alcoholic, we can't have God in a box. So I take them through this work just as much. Page 55, paragraph 2, it says that, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Now, the big book says it's down there. So I tell them, I say, this is not a question of faith. You have the faith. According to this book, I believe that you know there's a God. You just don't want to admit it. I don't think so. Well, let's look a little further. See, it's a question of willingness, not faith. Page 46, paragraph 1. Yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. So it's the willingness thing. That's the problem. Because I think that deep down, if I will get in touch with that deep down, I know there's a higher power. So I will tell these atheists and these agnostics this. I said, suppose, you know, we got deer season fixing to open here. I say, suppose I'm going out in the woods deer hunting with a friend, and we're in this cabin. We got our guns broke apart. We're cleaning them up. We're going to get up early in the morning and go out and get in the deer blind, you know. And this is another analogy. So I'm talking to this dude a little bit about God, you know, and he's an atheist or an agnostic. He's going, I don't know if I believe in God. Nah, I don't know if I buy into that, you know. And so we're fixing to blow out the little kerosene lamp and hit the rack because we got to get up early. And I said, well, I say, listen, suppose there is a God outside this cabin who would like to come in here tonight while we're asleep and leave some evidence just for you so you'll know. Maybe some cookie crumbs or some footprints or something. And this atheist, this agnostic would say, well, I don't really think I believe in all that. Just in case, I'm going to lock the door. Now, I could have another atheist or agnostic would say, well, I'm really not sure I believe all that. But just in case, I'll leave the door unlocked. Both of them profess to be atheist, agnostic, but their attitude is 100 degrees apart when it comes to willingness. And all I need in this program is to be willing to unlock the door. Page 46, paragraph 2. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with Him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took the rest of the steps. Now, notice this. I always ask the atheist or the agnostic, I say, listen, can you prove to me there is no God? I can assure you he's going to try. He's going to tell me about Darwin's theory of evolution and the survival of the fittest and the fossil record and it's once you know and I'm going to stick with my original question and say, yeah, but can you prove to me there's no God? Because those arguments don't prove. So at best he'll have to throw up his hands and just say, okay, I can't prove there's no God, but you can't prove to me that there is. I say, well, I'm not trying to prove to you that there is. I'm just trying to get you to admit that you can't prove that there's not. Because as soon as I've got you to admit that you can't prove that there's no God, I've got you to admit the possibility that there is one. And that's all you need to do for step two, is admit that you may be wrong. Can you admit that you might possibly, maybe just 1/10 of 1,000th, it doesn't matter what small percentage, you're willing to admit that you may be wrong. That's all we need. Some famous person one time said that from a speck the size of a mustard seed, he could grow the whole kingdom of God. So all I'm trying to do is get that speck of possibility based on the fact that you can't prove that there is no God. So now if you didn't want to unlock the door just to see what would happen, well, I've just given you a good enough reason to unlock the door and work the rest of the steps and see what will happen. The 12 and 12 says all you really need is an open mind. And I just got to get them to unlock their mind. That's all. Once unlocked by willingness, it says the door seems to open almost by itself. God will just walk right in. It's not up to me to prove God to you. It's up to me to help you just unlock the door and to give you enough reason to do it. And then God will walk into your life and prove Himself to you. And you'll have your own personal experience with God that nobody else can tell you that He is or isn't and talk you out of. And that's the only kind that an alcoholic can get sober on, is a very deep personal experience. The big book talked about the guy out there at the end of this chapter. He said that, you know, this thunderbolt thought hit his mind, said, "Who are you to say there's no God?" And he tumbled out of bed and felt he was in the presence of infinite power. It said, "Thus was our friend's cornerstone firmly fixed in place. No later vicissitude has shaken it." I got to have that, or that mental blank spot will get me someday. Page 47, paragraph 2. We needed to ask ourselves this one simple question. Do I now believe, or am I just willing to believe? Am I just willing to unlock the door based on the slight possibility that I may be wrong, that there's no God? If I'm a religious person, maybe I'm slightly wrong and God doesn't perfectly fit into my box. Maybe I can have a new experience with God in AA that I didn't find in church. Does that possibility exist? I hope you can unlock your mind to that possibility. Am I just willing? Step 3, made a decision to turn our will in life. See, it's always been about the will. The willingness. Made a decision to turn our will in life over to the care of God as we understood Him. And just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? Well, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Charlie read that earlier. And the first thing we're going to have to do is redefine success. Because I know a lot of self-will people out there flying in Lear jets with millions and billions put away that the world calls successful. And they're living on self-will because they've left probably a few bodies along the way. What do you mean any life run on self-will can hardly be a success? Obviously, we're going to have to redefine what we mean by success, aren't we? Page 61, paragraph 1. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of life if he only manages well? That's success is, have I quit wrestling with life to find happiness? No wonder in October when the stock market crashed in 1929, men were jumping from the towers of high finance. They were not successful men. They were just propped up with their wealth. So we have to redefine that, and that's the second part of step one, is redefining what we mean by success. Being able to quit wrestling and struggling with life to try to have some sanity, some peace of mind. And so when we sincerely took this position, first of all, we had to quit playing God, and next we had to let God be the director. When we sincerely took such a position, we're on page 63, paragraph 1. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed. if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. There is a stipulation. Bill Wilson said, simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. This all-powerful God going to come into my life and do all kind of remarkable things, bringing all His power to bear upon my life to just, you know, to amaze me with remarkable things, if I will agree to keep close to Him and perform His work well. That's what step three is, a decision. It's reaching a decision. Do I want to agree to those terms? Did you know on page 28 of the big book it says, all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms. There are terms to forming a relationship with God. And I don't dictate those terms. God does. I've tried to dictate a few. God, get me out of this one. Y'all know those. And I will promise, you know. But God dictated these terms. God never bought any of my conditions and terms. But now He offered me a contract, a deal, whatever you want to call it. And I don't have to take it. But if I want this all-powerful being to step in and manage my life in a remarkable way, there are terms and conditions. It says on page 46 of the big book that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. Notice it did not say that God does not make too hard terms for them. It says with them. This is a union, a contractual agreement between us and our higher power, that I'm going to turn over this part of my life, you know, I'm going to turn over the managing of my life to my higher power. And He's going to do that as a response to me doing this, keeping close to Him and performing His work well. By the way, that paraphrases into stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. How do I keep close to Him and perform His work well? Step 4 through 9 is how I get close to God. Now, 10 and 11 is how I keep close to Him, and 12 is how I perform His work well. Are you willing to live by those steps? Do you want to make this agreement with God? I need to clearly understand that to have this power working in my life, it's going to work in response to me acting upon my part of the agreement. And so I have to, it says, to think well before taking this step. Make sure you're ready. Says the wording is quite optional so long as we express the idea of voicing it without reservation. I need to really think about this. Do I fully understand that I'm entering into a contractual agreement with my higher power? And then I mean, this is going to open a new door of possibilities. Now I know how to really engage the power of God. I never knew how. I used to sit around and pray and why didn't it not work? And now I know it follows very certain and specific actions. Very certain and specific actions. For me to reach out and try to help one of y'all. For me to do my inventory at night to make sure I'm maintaining a clear conscious contact with God. Why? So that He can direct me when I reach out to help some of y'all. He's really trying to get to you. And He really wants me and He really wants you to help each other. It's very important to God. In fact, He's willing to give you His best if you'll just give yourself to Him, to let Him use you, alcoholics. There's a lot of love in that. Charlie, what, you know, you talk about that pink dress girl. That's just the love of God, brother. It's just the love of God. We feel it for each other, don't we? Established on such a footing. What footing? A clear understanding that I'm entering into a contractual agreement with my higher power. I know now how to engage the power of God. I know what to do to make the connection. No matter how big of an engine you got in your car, if you don't know how to let the clutch out and engage that power and transfer that power to the rear wheels, you don't go anywhere. And this contract is where I engage the power of God and transfer that power into my life. And if I don't know those terms and which specific actions to take, it's like sitting in neutral and gunning your engine and begging and crying and praying hard and going nowhere. I found the missing piece. And established on this footing, I become less and less interested in myself and my plans and designs. I'm no longer in the managing my life business. Now I'm interested in seeing what I can do to help y'all, it says. Why? Because that's how I get God to act in my life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, I'm no longer wrestling to get happiness out of life. As we enjoyed peace of mind, as we became conscious of His presence, God gets involved with us around this. Man, every time I reach out to help one of y'all, I feel God. As we became conscious of His presence, we begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. Wow, what a deal. We thought well before taking this step. I want y'all to really approach that step three and think about this contractual agreement. And do you mean it? Because God does. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor, but it's better to do it alone than with somebody who might misunderstand. What does that mean? Someone who doesn't grasp the gravity of this moment that is so precious when I say I do to God. You know, there's a place in the Bible that compares entering into a covenant agreement with God, it compares it to marriage. Doing step three is supposed to be like saying, I do to God and becoming married to God for a purpose to help other alcoholics. It says, this was only the beginning. Though if honestly and humbly made, in effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once. And I usually tell my guys, I say, here's what you're feeling right now. You're feeling a sense of anticipation like, whoa, I just entered into a contractual agreement with the Creator of the universe. That if I would do a few simple things, He would bring all His power to bear upon my life to do remarkable things so that I would have a story to tell. Wow, I'm sitting here with anticipation. I don't really know what my future looks like. But I think it's going to be different from my past. You know, I'm like, they're starting to take, you know, civilians up on the shuttle, you know. And man, can you imagine if I'm sitting here strapped down in the Columbia, you know, shuttle thing and been getting ready for this. I got my suitcase packed, everything's ready. But now all of a sudden they got me strapped into the chair and I hear somebody on a speaker somewhere going, 10, 9, 8. Oh my God. Anticipation. I don't know what's up there. But man, is the adrenaline flowing. And that's what I should be feeling if I properly do step three. I should feel like I'm sitting onto a launch pad of I have no idea what's fixing to happen. The big book says we are rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed, where the central fact of our life becomes the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. That's steps 1, 2, and 3.